Okay, my name is Francina Turner, and I am conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Daryl Hill for the Reparative Histories and the Black Experience at UMD Oral History Project. And so, Mr. Hill, is it possible for you to angle? Yeah, there we go.
How's, is that better?
Yeah, that's
Yeah.
better.
Okay.
So the way I'm kind of gonna frame our discussion is I'll ask a little bit about your time before UMD. At UMD, and then a little bit about what you've done since.
Okay.
And so I want to start with what is your hometown?
I'm from Washington, D.C.
Okay. And what's your birthday?
October 21st, 1943.
Okay. And how would you describe your life prior to coming to UND in terms of maybe family makeup or composition, your home community, that kind of thing?
Well, I'm a native Washingtonian. Both of my parents from D.C. My father was a businessman, had a trucking company. My mother was a secondary school teacher, Howard University graduate, and a PhD from Catholic University. I grew up in far northeast Washington, sort of in a middle income, middle upper class Black community. The school I went to, which was adjacent to a public house, adjacent to the community, was a public housing project. So I went to school in the project. So that's where I learned how to play sports and how to get how to be tough. So and from there I went to Gonzaga High School, which is a
Gonzaga High
Jesuit
School.
school in
Okay.
DC.
Okay. How did you make your decision to attend UMD?
Well, it was a difficult decision. I went to Navy. I was at Naval Academy, and I was a football player, along with Roger Staubach. And we decided we were going to leave Navy. Maryland showed up one day and offered me a scholarship or come to visit the campus. And I basically told them, "No, thank you. You're in a segregated conference, and why are you calling on me?" And that's Maryland said, "Well, that's just the point. We're tired, we're done with this segregation, and we think you're the guy." So Lee Corso was the assistant backfield coach at that time, and I told him I wasn't trying to be Jackie Robinson. I was going to go to Notre Dame, Penn State. But then he challenged me. He said, "Are you scared?" So he pressed the right button. So I wound up going to Maryland. And that was a great decision on my
What
part.
year did you and what year was it that you enrolled at
I
Maryland?
enrolled in Maryland in 1962.
Okay.
I had to sit out a year football wise because I was a transferred from another school. So my first year in football in Maryland was 1963. I graduated with a degree in economics in 1965.
Okay. How did you decide on economics as a major?
I was talking with some friends of my father one day, and I said, "What should I take where I could make the most money?" So they said, "Take economics." I said, "What's that?" So that's how I decided.
If you could walk me through your memories of the first time you walked onto campus as a transfer student.
Well, my experience was a little different because I got to campus before everybody, all the other students enrolled because we had football practice. There was not much to think of. For me to go to Maryland wasn't a big deal because I had gone to an all-white high school. I went to the Naval Academy. So I was used to being in a severe minority. There were only 12 blacks out of 4,000 midshipmen. So Maryland was it wasn't a traumatic experience in the least. So it was just there.
You said there were 12 blacks out of at the Naval Academy, you mean?
Yeah, out of 4,000 midshipmen, there were just 12 of us
Oh, okay.
at that time.
When you attended Maryland, did you live on campus? What were your living arrangements?
Yeah, I lived in Talbot Hall, which is the smallest dormitory on campus, still is, I think. It's still there. Every now and then I'll ride by and take a look at it. I didn't figure this out, but in later years, I kind of now calculated when I went and took a look at Talbot Hall, was that maybe the football department put me there where I would have the fewest number of other students to deal with. So it was a small dorm as being in one of the bigger, more populated dorms. I liked it, had a good time.
Now, I know that being an athlete can take up all of your time, but were you involved in any organizations on campus, any student clubs?
No, not really. Not because of the demands of athletics necessarily. I'm just not much of a club, type of guy, so I didn't belong to any clubs in any of the schools I went to particularly. I can remember the Kappas at Howard University. I used to hang out up there because there was only about 30 or 40 Blacks on campus at Maryland, if that, at the time. So I used to hang out at Howard, and the Kappas asked me to start a Kappa chapter at Maryland, And I said, okay, maybe I'll do this. And they said, well, first you got to go online at Howard, before you can go start a chapter. And by this time, I was an All-American football player. I said, look, well, these little punks get in my face with a paddle or something, I'm going to knock them out. I said, never mind. So that was my experience with clubs. So I wasn't involved with anything particularly on campus.
Okay. So when you were attending classes, you said there were like very few Black students on campus at the time. What was that like? I know you told me that you had gone to an all-white high school. So did you feel, how did you feel being a student on campus?
Well, I didn't feel, I was used to it, I think more so the fact that I was who I was and what I was doing. So I was known on campus, so there was a lot of gawking and, so forth, there's Daryl Hill over there, but nothing negative happened. I didn't have any negative experiences on campus. I was never confronted, with any racial harassment at all. Again, part and parcel of that had, I was an athlete, so that probably helped. But life on campus with the few Blacks that were there, there was a couple hundred Blacks probably in the school out of 38,000 students, but only 30 or 40 of us lived in a dormitory, lived on campus. And we hung out together for sure. We spent time together. We said, we had our own little area in the student center, where we would go and meet, and eat and, convene. So it was fine. It was okay. There were certain places in College Park where we couldn't go. There was a very popular place. I think it's still there, actually, called Town Hall, which was down on Route 1. And, I went down there and they turned me away. And so my football teammates came back on mass and threatened to take the place down. But I said, look, it's not worth it. They don't want me. I don't want to go there. So
now, was Town Hall a restaurant?
It was a restaurant. Oh, okay. It was sort of like a student hangout joint. Yeah. Okay. But there were other restaurants on campus that I could go to.
Now, you said that you all sort of hung out at a spot in the union,
right?
In the student center. What was that spot?
One of the places we used to hang out in the bowling alley, actually, and that was one place. We were sitting up in the chairs in the stands. The bowling alley, and then I think there was, I can't remember, but it seems like there was a table or so where we would eat. But I remember the bowling alley. And I can remember an incident that happened while we were there. Camille Hanks Cosby was there. She was dating Bill at the time. Oh. And he came and sat up there with us while, and she was taking a class in bowling. And she couldn't bowl very well. And he was hilarious. I mean, he was so funny. You know, he was making all these jokes. And I remember falling down on the floor and I got stuck between the chairs because he was funny. that was our place. And, the few Black sisters that lived on campus, I remember Wicomico Hall. They kind of bunched the girls in two or three dorms together at that time, which was, I think, a good thing, actually.
Do you think, I know your situation is a little different because of, because you were an athlete, but did you come to find in your interactions with other Black students that they came from the same sort of couple of cities?
They were mostly from Baltimore at the time. Most of the Blacks, I would say half of them were from Baltimore, and the others were, other places scattered around the state.
Do you remember there being any campus protests during your time at UMD? Any student?
There were some, yes. I can remember that they sat in the dean's or president's office, making certain demands. And I recall that, like I said, I used to hang out at Howard. So I knew Stokely Carmichael and H-Rap Brown. And so SNCC kind of asked me. Oh, no, there hadn't been any. Yeah, that's what, at one point, SNCC asked me to say, we'd like you to go out there and do some demonstrations or lead some demonstrations on campus. And I said, no, I don't have the time to do that. My job in the movement is to play football and take down the barriers in sports. Rap Brown got up in my face a little bit. We had a little tussle, actually. He was a fiery kind of guy, so Stokely had to get between us. But no, I didn't do anything. But toward the end of my time there, there were some sort of peaceful demonstrations on the campus.
I know over the years, Stokely Carmichael spoke frequently at Maryland. Did he come to campus any while you were there?
Did not, that I recall. Okay. No.
I know you mentioned a student center, but are there any other physical spaces on campus where you felt really comfortable?
Not really. The football field and the locker room. Where my teammates and I hung out mostly.
And I know you mentioned that your teammates had your back when it came to that segregated bar. How did you feel received by your teammates when you came on campus, when you first came?
Well, most of the young men on the team at the time were from the north. So they were used to playing ball with other African Americans. They didn't have the same attitudes as some of the local Marylanders, especially, those were like, there were parts of Maryland that were pretty tough, like Southern Maryland and, racially. There was a fraternity on campus. In fact, I was talking with a Maryland alumnus the other day who was there when I was there. And this fraternity, Kappa Alpha, they were based out of the South, big Southern fraternity. That out of Atlanta. And they had a fraternity row, where hello?
I'm sorry, you froze, I froze, or you, one of us froze for a second. Could you
just start that story okay. over? Yeah, so there was a fraternity, Kappa Alpha, that was based out of the South. They had a house on the horseshoe there on Route 1 where all the fraternity sorority houses are, the very first house. And they flew the Confederate flag off this house. And they were heard in the stands making some disparaging statements at a game about me and my football roommate, Jerry Fishman, who was Jewish. You know, and they would say, ah, they got the Jew and the nigger, and we ain't winning, you know. And so Fishman is a big, tough guy. And he got mad and marched down to Kappa Alpha House with a couple of boys and tore the flag down and kind of threatened them, you know, a little bit if I hear this again. But still, football team was kind of basically behind me almost all the time. But aside for that little incident, there wasn't much going on in terms of, you know, harassment on the campus. I enjoyed my time there. I thought that you treated well. There were incidents, for example, when I first got there in my first year, the registrar refused to accept my registration, you know, and let me register for classes. He blocked it off. So the president of the university had to step in, you know, kind of clear that up. So they were kind of little incidents, you know. For example, whoever was running the yearbook for Maryland, 1964 yearbook, 64 yearbook, where I had a big season in football. There wasn't a single picture of me in the yearbook anywhere.
And I looked for you in that yearbook, and I just couldn't.
That's
not all students take pictures, but I'm thinking he would have been in the yearbook.
I wasn't in the yearbook, in the dormitory pictures. I wasn't in the individual pictures, or the football pictures. Even the team picture of the team all together in one step, on one shot, they did a picture of the team before I got there. They didn't put the picture that should have been there wasn't there. So I can gather from that whoever was running the yearbook staff had some problems, because I was not in there. And if you look through there, you won't see any Blacks in that yearbook.
And I have looked through it.
So you hear what I'm saying.
Yes. How did you, at the time that you were on campus, I think the Diamondback might have been the only newspaper. Or one of very few.
It was that I recall the only newspaper, right?
Did you feel how did you feel about Diamondback's coverage of you?
I don't recall that I had a problem with it, you know. But I just don't remember exactly, you know, what happened. But it did nothing jumps out at me and says that I felt misrepresented or shortchanged.
Okay. Do you remember from your time, professors who might have been professors or administrators, faculty and staff, who might have been really supportive or maybe not so supportive?
Neither. Mm-hmm. I think they were, you know, for the most part, pretty neutral. They treated me like another student. Mm-hmm. I never felt like my grades were adversely affected. You know, I got what I thought I should have gotten. And I never had a problem with a professor. And I didn't have any problem with dormitory management, you know, anything to that effect. Actually, it wasn't a challenging experience on campus at all. I thought it was fairly even-handed.
You mentioned that you were an All-American in sports. How does one become an All-American?
By playing well. I led the conference in pass receiving and touchdowns and kickoff returns, you know, and so forth, and was ranked in the nation in those departments. So that's how you become the sports writers. Look at the numbers and they say, oh yeah, you know, he did this, he did that. Okay. I wasn't a first team All-American, but I was, you know, like second, third team in there.
Okay. Walk me through your memories of the last time you walked off campus as a student, so around graduation. What are your memories of that experience?
Well, I remember graduation itself. And by that time, I had a 2-year-old daughter. I was married, by the way, when I was living there. So I sort of split my living between living with my family at home, with my my family. We live with my parents at the time, and living on campus. So yeah, so during the week, I would stay on campus and go home on the weekends. But I remember my last thing I do remember is if I'm walking down the aisle to get the diploma, my little 2-year-old runs out into the aisle and kind of grabs me by the leg. You know? And everybody got a good laugh out of that, you know. But other than that, I don't have any, you know, thing that jumps out at me, you know. Okay. I mean, we did all kinds of crazy stuff. I was a prankster in school, so.
Do you remember any of the pranks you played?
Well, I can remember taking my car. And so the parking lot, big parking lot that's over by the Coalfield House, what was Coalfield House. Mm-hmm. That, by the way, is now the Jones Hill House. So I remember speeding across it after a snowstorm, and I had a little sports car and making it spin around, you know, on stuff. I remember we used to take the trays out of the dining hall and, you know, it slide down the hill when it snowed, stuff like that, you know, nothing really major. Let's see, is there anything else? You know, we hung out in the bars. I wasn't a big drinker, but you know, we were always doing some mischief or another.
Okay. You mentioned that. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's all. Go on.
You mentioned that Coalfield House is now has had a name change. How did that come to be in terms of your involvement? At what point?
Well, yeah, I think
about that.
I think it basically came from Kevin Plank, who put up most of the capital to renovate Coalfield House into, you know, a football, indoor football practice facilities. And so he suggested that they name it after myself and Billy Jones, who was the first Black basketball player at Maryland. And so, yeah, I thought that was a nice gesture.
Mm-hmm. Now, I can tell, obviously, from the pictures and the newspaper articles that you came back to campus for that. But post-graduation, what was your relationship to the university? Did you maintain the relationship or did you get called home?
Well, I worked for the university for 7-8 years. I was director in the 80s. Oh, well, not 80s, what am I saying? The 2000s, mm-hmm. like up until maybe 2010. So I worked there as director of major gifts for athletics. So I was basically the major fundraiser for the athletic department.
Okay. Well, in that grain, let's back up. So you graduate. What are your next steps after graduation?
Well, I went off to play with the Jets for a minute. Mm-hmm. Then I took it, you know, then I went into the job market, and I got involved very early in what at the time they called Black capitalism, mm-hmm. which was now minority business development. And so I was ran some major agencies, the Greater Washington Business Center, which mm-hmm. its primary job was minority business development for the Middle Atlantic seaboard region. So I was head of that. I headed the Anacostia Economic Development Corporation, which was a community development organization. And then I moved up to the chairman of the National Minority Purchasing Council, which is now the National Minority Supply and Development Council. So, you know, my first 10 years or so was spent fostering and promoting, you know, minority business enterprise. And then I went into business for myself after that and wound up opening the first Black-owned fine dining restaurant in the United States. Mm-hmm. That was called W.H. Bone and Company. Because I just thought that the restaurants that we did own were mostly neighborhood, small neighborhood restaurants, you know. And, you know, God bless her, Sylvia's in New York, which is a lovely place. But it's a small, you know, local restaurant. It wasn't a mainstream fine dining restaurant. So every other ethnic group in the world had restaurants except African-Americans. And I thought that was crazy. So I opened one myself to kind of
fill that gap. And where did you open that?
It was down on the Southwest waterfront in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
And so I opened that in 1977. And then I opened a similar one in Atlanta in around 2000. And then I opened another one in D.C., downtown D.C., mm-hmm. Called the Savoy, which was at 19th and M. And that was a big, you know, mm-hmm. expensive, you know, restaurant. And all of these restaurants were like first class mainstream fine dining, waiters in tuxedos, white tablecloths, you know, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. Because I thought that we needed to have that. So I did that.
Now,
from there.
Oh, no, go ahead.
From there, I went to Russia and started buying businesses in Russia. And so I bought an optical company, and then I wound up with a large timber and forestry company in Siberia. So did that.
Okay. How do you end up in Russia? I got to know that story.
One day a buddy of mine, 1991 to be exact, said, let's go to Eastern Europe. The Iron Curtain was coming down. Mm-hmm. Okay. So he said, let's go to Eastern Europe and let's check out the countries, you know, before they get westernized. So, you know, we flew into East Germany and we got a car. We drove to Poland, to Czechoslovakia, you know, we were going to drive on down to Hungary and so forth. Mm-hmm. And he said, let's go to Moscow. I said, well, we can't drive there. So he said, yeah, but we can fly there. And next week is May Day, their big holiday. And, you know, we can go hang out and be the first Americans, you know, on Red Square, you know, without the KGB shadow. And so I said, nah. And then he said, they got pretty girls in Russia. I said, oh, well, maybe I'll change my mind. So we went there, and then it was like a big candy store in Russia. The Iron Curtain and communism had gone away, but it would be like one man owned every business in the United States, every single business, all the restaurants, the mining, the automobiles, insurance, you know, you name it. That was the deal in Russia. There was no private enterprise. It was all owned by the communist government. And so all of a sudden, this one man says, it's all for sale. Make me an offer. So in that event, I made him an offer. The first thing I did, I started bringing Jeeps. I imported Jeep Cherokees from U.S. to Russia. Mm-hmm. Until I found out that my partners in that venture were the Russian mafia. I didn't know. Yeah, they put up a front guy that one day, guy walks to my office and says, Mr. Hill, I'm your real partner. My name is Sergey. You know? And he said, I'm head of local mafia. This was in a city called Novosibirsk, which is in Siberia. Mm-hmm. I said, Sergey, really? He said, yeah. He said, but not to worry, you know, we're going to make some money together. You know, I'll sell the cars. And he did, you know. So we sell the cars and he would come to my office in a ruble for me, ruble for you, ruble for me, ruble for you. Yeah, and that went on. But then I bought an optical company that made telescopes and binoculars and night vision equipment. But what I figured out is in Russia at the time, I think still now, if it didn't have to do with war, they weren't very good at it. It came to nuclear submarines and, you know, MiG jets. Yeah, they were the best in the business. But, you know, consumer products just wasn't their thing. So I wound up going way into Siberia to the Republic of Buryatia. And timber had been their big industry. And I said, how come you're not selling any trees anymore? I said, I see all this equipment you got here, you know, tractors and loaders and strippers and it's gathering rust, you know, what's the deal, you know? And they said, well, when communism went away, he said, the communist government used to just call us up and say, cut so many cubic meters of timber and send it to Kazakhstan, you know, cut so many cubic meters and send it to Georgia. And we just followed orders. We cut the trees and everything was doing. He said, now all these places, Georgia, Kazakhstan, Ukraine, and so forth, they're all now independent countries and they all broke. So he said, they don't have money to buy timber. We don't have a market for the timber. I said, okay, well, look, you're right across the Strait of Sea of Japan from Japan. They ain't got a tree. And you're right on the border with China. They got some trees, but not enough to feed the booming, growing economy. So why don't you sell to them? And they said, well, we don't know how. So I said, okay, let's make a deal. I'll go get the markets. You put up the equipment and machinery and cut the trees, and we'll form a 50-50 partnership, which we did. And I still get, you know, little dribbles of checks from them, you know, every now and then. So that's how all that happened. And, you know, it was just strange to be a Black man in Siberia. It was interesting, to say the least. There's a lot more stories related to that, but, you know, I'll let it rest there. So that's how I got there.
How did you come to make the decision to come back to UMD as an employee?
I came back and I opened these restaurants, as I told you, and I opened one in Atlanta. You know, Shirley Franklin, the mayor, was a friend of mine, and and then one day a big national chain made me an offer I couldn't refuse to buy my restaurant. So I took it, you know, and I was sitting around talking to the football coach, Ralph Regan. He invited me to come and address the football teams one day. And so I came over, and so Debbie Yao was the athletic director at the time, and Debbie came over and said, well, Daryl, you know, what are you doing? I said, well, I sold my Russian businesses. I'm going to play golf. She said, well, why don't you come work for me? I said, well, that'd be nice, Debbie, but I've never had a job, which I've never had. You know, I'd always been the boss or owned my own business. In the case of the nonprofit businesses, I still was running the show. I didn't have anybody to report to. Simple board of directors. So she said, well, don't worry. She said, I want you to just relate to our really big, you know, donors. You know, just hang out with them and just, you know, and raise, you know, the big money. So, which I did. And so I said, well, Debbie, you know, I don't know about punching the clock and coming to an office, you know. And so she said, well, we'll give you an office. You come when you want to, you know, just attend the staff meetings and, you know, you go off and do your thing. So that's what I did. So, you know, the Tizer Tower, for example, that's there in the football stadium now. I raised the millions of dollars it took to build that Tizer Center. And so it was the major.
I couldn't hear you.
Tizer Tower, you know, where all the suites and, you know, presidents, all the suites and all that. And I was the one who facilitated capitalizing that project, raising the money to build that project. Also, the name of the stadium. So I sold the naming rights to at the time it was PNC Bank. It's now whoever, Capital Bank now, who bought PNC Bank. So it was a naming deal in which a lot of schools were moving in that direction, you know, and pro teams, particularly selling the naming rights, you know, we got the Infinity Center that was sold. And so I sold a football deal, which at the time was the largest naming right deal in college, in the history of college athletics. Which was also more interesting because they wouldn't let me sell the name of the stadium. So they said, well, it's going to stay Bird Stadium. You can only name the football field. So still to this day, so it's Capital One Field, but not Capital One Stadium. Mm-hmm. So that's how that all came about. So, you know, I worked at Maryland maybe 10 years, eight to 10 years. It was great experience. You know, I liked it, you know, working with athletes and, you know, and they paying me to just go hang out with these high rollers, you know, like go to their yachts and play golf and, you know, fly around the country with, you know, and had a good time. So Maryland has been a positive experience for me from day one. So when I was coming there, Wilson Elkins, who was the president of Maryland, when I went there, the ACC was very upset about them bringing a black athlete to play in the ACC. Mm-hmm. And they threatened the two South Carolina schools, Clemson being one, and the University of South Carolina, which is not in the ACC any longer, but it was at the time. They said, well, you bring that Negro there, as they refer to blacks back then, and we're going to leave the conference. So Maryland said, you got to do what you got to do, but he's coming. And so they stood by me the whole time. So I have a high respect for the school and the administration. You know, they never wavered, you know, they never backed off amidst a lot of threats. There was a cadre of trustees from Maryland at the time who were like from Southern Maryland and so forth, who were real anti, you know, black. They stood them down too, you know, so the board of trustees, you know, just over voted them. And they said, look, you know, this is what we're going to do. So, you know, more or less, you know, Maryland has a lot to be proud of in terms of what it's done racially. You know, I mean, it's got one of the earlier black athletic directors, black head coach, you know, football coach, and, you know, other, and going all the way back, you know, to Bob Wade, who was football coach way back, you know. Mm-hmm. In the day, about not football, basketball coach. And so those are accomplishments I think this school can pat its back on. And it's also been very progressive as far as women are concerned too, you know. So female athletic directors, you know, women coaches of major sports. So Maryland has been on the cutting edge, and which is cool, which is good. Okay. So my thoughts about the school are all positive. You know, my experience being as a student there was positive. My experience working there is positive, and my feeling as an alumni there is also positive. I don't think they've sidestepped any issues or backed up on anybody or anything. So
okay, and so as a closing question, and I really think I should share this question ahead of time so people can have time to think, but I'll go ahead and ask it. Is there anything you'd like to share about your time at UMD as a message to current or future students? Like, as an advice or?
I think it's important that students know and understand the history that Maryland has and what it's done. Mm-hmm. And I think that they should be proud of the university in that regard. Mm-hmm. I think it's one of the better schools from a social point of view, as well as an academic point of view. Mm-hmm. And when I talk to young people who are trying to decide on schools, I said, take this one. And so if you are a student there, it's something to be proud of. And if you haven't had the chance, and this project that you're working on right now is doing just that, learn what the deal is. Mm-hmm. And what the school's about. And if you have time, be active and involved in trying to make it better. Keep pushing on it. You know, it's just, there's still a ways to go in college education in general, and Maryland is not excluded from that. So, you know, try to keep pushing for better situations, and, you know, from top to bottom.
Okay.
You know, just don't sit around passive. I looked at the Washington Post, you know, and under the bylines of the Post, it says, democracy dies in darkness. And so essentially, if you're just passive as a student, you know, you're missing out. You know, you should be involved. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I want to thank you for agreeing to talk to me for this interview. It has been very enlightening. And if you could, once we get off, if you could send me the consent form.
Yes, I'll do that.
Okay. And I just want to thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I thank you for what you're doing. And I'm assuming there's going to be a finished product that comes out of all of this.
Absolutely. We're working on doing a digital project, some written projects, and of course the interviews will be deposited in a repository in the university archives.
Oh, really? Okay. Mm-hmm. Is Ann Turcos, is she still head of the archives, or do you know?
Well, the university archivist is Lael Watkins.
Oh, okay. All right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not sure so who's the head of the library, but the university archivist is Lael Watkins.
Okay. Yeah, no, Ann, I guess, was her predecessor, who was there for years and years. She's probably retired, you know, maybe by now. Mm-hmm. All right, very good. And thank you, and thank you for what you're doing. And,
okay.
And
thank
I
you
will
so much.
I'll look to see, you know, what comes out of all of this.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. All right. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.